Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tenkill by Shannon Kirk. Narrated by Allison Ryan. Our systems of legal education, bar licensing, court review, and peer relationships simply have not been good enough to guard against this weaponization of lawyers. We need to do better. No one thing will fix it. But I'd start with the need to specifically train law students and lawyers to take stands when they or others are asked to do things that erode ethics or democracy. Matthew Siegel, ACLU MA Legal Director. Part 1. Motion to explain why I'm on the run. Chapter 1. I look out from the covered porch onto the wide wedges of Queen Anne's lace, a sea of white blooms and orange monarchs fluttering above. It is August in Massachusetts. Standing here in workout gear, I sip chocolatey coffee, hot and sugary with frothed milk. A warm wind, a country setting, I should be at peace. I'm not. This gorgeous, somewhat otherworldly scenery is dissonant with my inner turmoil, waiting here, hiding here, knowing I must run again. I'm a lawyer of 11 years, a partner in my third firm, Corse & Cotton, a big law, international powerhouse. COCO is what Gossip Law Blog, Above the Law, calls it, as do all the Ivy League law students performing death matches in the Coliseum of connections and pedigree and grades to clinch limited summer associate spots. It's all so insane. These summers are spoiled with box seats at baseball games and dinners at oceanfront mansions, cocktails on Hinckley yachts, only to maybe get a job upon graduating law school, toiling 80 to 100-hour weeks, reviewing documents for me, the firm's global head of e-discovery and deputy general counsel. I don't blame them. The temptation of money is irresistible, and I'm jaded, looking backwards on the process. But the truth remains, in exchange for all of your time, the pay is obscene, and the environment is all halls of chrome and glass and fine art. You feel as supernatural, as untouchable as a rich man on an advanced planet. This hard imagery, these inside lines of privilege and metal and cut glass, enameled white walls and sterility, this is the inner conflict I feel now, hiding here with stolen data, in a serene field of plump color and fluttering life. A purple-bodied dragonfly lands on the natural wicker chair at my side. I watch him. He watches me. His wings are translucent green with veins of pink. He is the opposite of the white walls and the straight halls of Corse & Cotton. 3 days ago, I programmed my firm email out-of-office autoresponder. My message says the typical vacation words and how I'm not checking email on a regular basis, and I'm not checking voicemail. I am positive that numerous partners and associates have received this auto message and pursued me regardless, sending a counter-response that always starts with, "Greta, I'm sorry to trouble you. I know you're on vacation, but..." I wouldn't know for sure because I left my firm iPhone in my Boston penthouse, since the firm's MDM software, mobile device management, tracks GPS to Air Striker precision. I should know. I'm the one who instituted COCO's Enhanced Information Security Governance Program on mobile devices. I meant it for defensive security. I didn't know they'd use it for offensive spying. They'll be suspicious by now, for sure. I always, as do all COCO lawyers, respond to emails while on vacation within the hour, no matter what your OOO says. I haven't read or responded to one in 3 days. And I won't use my personal iPhone, tied to an anonymous shell company I set up a month ago, to log into my firm's webmail, because they track those IP address logins too. I didn't tell anyone where I was going on vacation. I certainly didn't say that I copied another partner's emails and I'm on the run from my own firm. How did this all start? I consider this question as I consider the insane volume of orange and black butterflies before me. It's all so surreal. The circumstances leading me here to this vivid and wild concoction of nature in rural Massachusetts are jagged and mismatched. I must admit, I am whiplashed. I need time to regain my focus, pause here to regroup in the middle of the storm. Although, I must accept that in reality, despite that I've taken some serious action, the storm's just beginning. There is no room for error going forward. But a lot has happened up to now. It was one of those summers, one of those poor, spoiled souls who struck the flint on the tinder of suspicion of firm corruption I'd been worrying over since last year. A month and a half ago, on a bright June morning, strawberry blonde Summer Brad came to my chrome and glass office in the Sector 8, century floor of Boston's Prudential Building, or PRU. Coco rejects pedestrian floor numbers. I watched Summer Brad's 25-year-old eyes move across my nameplate, Greta Vinay Seville. After confirming I was, indeed, the partner he'd been emailing with on the case he was assigned to, Summer Brad stepped into my office. I watched him make quick study of my floor-to-ceiling windows and how they overlook Fenway and the crew-filled, winding black ribbon of the Charles. I adjusted a photo of me and Henry, a colleague of mine at my former firm. I adjusted the other framed photo of me, my brother, Toby, and our Aunt Violet, before she disappeared. These are the only framed pictures I have ever had on any desks anywhere. "Hi, I'm Brad," Summer Brad said, with cracked voice and shifting eyes, too shy to look me straight on. He took a seat in one of my black and chrome guest chairs. "I know, we've been emailing," I said, as a light tease and with a smile in an attempt to break the ice, make his twitching stop. It didn't. "Nice to meet you in person, Brad. I hope you're enjoying your summer so far, Coco. Entering your third year of law school in the fall. That's exciting." "Third year's the easiest," I said, trying to be nice, hoping he'd relax.
Yes,
he said quickly, nervously.
So, I sent you the PDF binder and..."
"Yes, I've got it open on my computer. Let's go through it, then." Summer Brad waited for my feedback while I clicked through his PDF binder of key documents. Key, meaning they were, simply put, very relevant to the case we were defending for a trade association. Brad and other associates had discovered these key documents amongst an ocean of 3 million documents we'd collected from that client. The team had been working their way through document batches using the firm's modernized document review software platforms, futuristically called CaseSpace AI and CaseCore, which are really just marking hype words to mean really great software that helps to more efficiently organize client documents. The lead partner, who owned the client relationship, had tapped me as e-discovery lead. My job, as always, is to usher the associates through continuous active learning, technology-assisted document review. It sounds intimidating, but the concept is rather simple. If you know how Pandora or Spotify work, how those music apps learn from the listener's thumbs up and down on each song, and then how the app feeds similar songs to what the listener likes, then you understand this technology. Basically, as the junior associates click responsive, relevant to the given case, i.e. like, if it were Pandora, on a document, the technology will find more documents like that one, and so on. This is obviously an efficient way of getting through 3 million documents. as Brad and his cohorts did this summer with this particular trade association's documents. Far more efficient than reviewing 3 million documents one by one in no particular order. Of course, it's more complicated than that, and that's why I have a job, but that's the gist. Out of the whole summer and junior associate team doing the document review, Summer Brad volunteered to go through the key documents with me. I wondered if he thought we'd go over things in a virtual setting, because now that he was in my physical office, he fidgeted in the guest chair, mumbling about each document in a barely audible running narration as I clicked and read. I kept saying, mm-hmm, with tight lips, wishing he'd take the hint and chill, let me read in peace. I stood, tilting to my toes in my 3-inch heels, and dropped the shade on my floor-to-ceiling window, because at noon, on a cloudless day, the ricochet glare on my cat-eye progressives kills my eyes and launches migraines. Brad winced over the loss of his view of Fenway, which I noted he'd been salivating over. I assumed he was longing to leave my cold office to get to the warmth of the firm's scheduled summer associate outing. And then, click, key document number 10. The font was minuscule, so I took off my progressives and put on my dedicated readers. Oh, wait, he said, leaning over my paperless desk, watching as I speed-read a 3-page email. I was on page 2 and not understanding why this one email had been marked key. It seemed like a totally non-relevant screed by a trade association employee on annual budgets that had nothing to do with the case at hand, the case we'd been hired to defend against. How Brad could even read what I was reading from his guest chair is explained by the fact that 25-year-old budding lawyers still have functional eyeballs. Even in my readers, I squinted to read the small font of key document number 10 and enlarged the view.
That's a mistake. I remembered that one. I thought I had marked that not relevant, Brad said in a deeper voice. Sorry about that. I'm sorry.
I kept reading, though, because I somehow caught, on the 3rd page, a buried line in a dense, cut-paste of a spreadsheet. The font was at the smallest, seemed smaller than 4-point, and the cut-paste into the email made the spreadsheet selection grainy and the cells wonky and merged, so I strained but read it and confirmed what I'd caught scrolling. The top row indicated the data was from 2014, 7 years old. Perhaps that's what stopped me to begin with. Why would there be 7-year-old data pasted into a recent email about current budgets? I shrunk the enlargement, pretended like what I read in that one tiny half-line, buried in smushed and blurred spreadsheet entries, was no big deal. But it was a big deal, for it said T. Honeywell estimated monthly $80K. And that, to me, based on other things I knew and was suspicious of, was like a pink neon billboard in a black desert. T. Honeywell estimated monthly $80K. This did not appear to my eyes as the mashed and fuzzy 4-point font of reality. It appeared as bold and 26-point font to me, for reasons I hope to make clear.
So this was a mistake, Brad? You didn't mean to mark this key?
His posture slumped, his white face red.
Yeah, sorry, he said.
I studied his nervousness over being wrong, his flushed face, the bead of sweat on his strawberry blonde brow, slumped posture, those filler uhs, and figured he was clueless as to the document's value. Brad was right. It was not relevant to the case at hand. But the reference to any payment, any reference at all to a T. Honeywell,
in this particular trade association's documents. A trade association brought to the firm by the partner I was most concerned about confirmed suspicions I had and warnings I'd been given. Simply put, the client was a group of private law enforcement corporations, private for-profit prisons, hired guards, private security, private investigations. I was concerned that the partner in charge of that client, Raymond Honeywell, was part of an illegal campaign finance scheme related to private prisons all over, but especially on the Texas border. The ones that caged asylum-seeking children in freezer cells after the U.S. government instituted a zero-tolerance policy to rip said children from their parents. Based on things I'd learned earlier in the year, I had a theory that our new COCO partner had secretly used the name Theodore Honeywell in the past in order to hide involvement in a prison donation kickback scheme. If I'm being honest, the only reason I'd agreed to be e-discovery lead on this case was I had an urge to prove my theory. I knew there was more, had good reason to suspect more. But how to prove it with evidence that Honeywell and others couldn't deny is the hard part, and Lord knows what other corruption would seep out from there. "It's fine, Brad. No worries," I said, using all my litigation prowess to be unemotional, give nothing away. I hoped he couldn't see beneath my desk how tight I'd coiled my legs to stem my heels from tapping.
"Cool, cool. So, can I, sort of head out, maybe? They have that Red Sox game, for the summers in an hour, and, I was, going to get a beer with my office mate."
Brad would not be getting an offer to join Corson Cotton at the end of the summer. Poor thing was honest and all, book smart by landing on law review at Harvard, the typical, typical summer. If he did get an offer, I could maybe have hidden him from the other less forgiving partners and summoned the patience to mold him and teach him to never ask to leave a partner's office in the middle of a case meeting to drink beer and go to a baseball game. To never slump and exude anything other than total confidence if you wished to join Coco's high-stakes litigation group. But Brad did not have the requisite sense of theater for Coco's litigation group, nor the innate instinct to flawlessly act your unflappable part at all times. He didn't have enough common sense to lie about wanting to get a beer, and that meant he couldn't survive the culture of Coco. As for making a mistake on the key document, that happens constantly. But the thing was, Brad didn't realize he was right. It was and is key. Key enough to push me to do what I ended up doing. My God, what have I done?
Chapter 2. When lawyers write motions, also called pleadings, they are basically asking the judge to give them something. There are motions to compel, in which you ask the court to require the opposing party to give you documents or other evidence. There are motions for summary judgment, in which you ask the court to rule that you've won the case because the facts and the law are so much in your favor, you don't have to go to trial in front of a jury. Those are just two examples. Between a motion to compel and a motion for summary judgment, there's a whole bunch of what's called discovery, which is when the parties to the litigation ask for and exchange documents, data, any kind of information they think will support their claims or defenses. And this is my focus, the discovery of electronic data, or e-discovery. How to collect documents, how to review millions of documents to find the stuff that the other party requests, that's my job. Amongst other client needs, like computer forensics or defending clients against a data breach by a hacker. In these motions, there is almost always a facts section in the beginning. This part tells the judge the facts that support why you're asking the court to make the other side do something or stop something, or rule in your favor in some way. So this is how my brain is thinking of the facts leading up to and after Summer Brad dropped his stink bomb of key document number 10 into my computer a month and a half ago. The facts, as they might appear in a motion, as they might appear in whatever future pleading is filed in a criminal complaint about all that I find myself in, would appear as follows. Motion to explain why I am on the run. Facts. May it please the court, the facts presented are as follows. 1. On or about May 3, 2011, Greta Vinay Seville lateraled to her second law firm, Stokes & Crane, as a second-year associate. She practiced there for 8 years, until May 14, 2019, when she lateraled as a partner to the law firm of Corson Cotton. 2. On or until June 1, 2020, when he resigned, Raymond Honeywell was the United States Attorney General under then-President Hubert M. Davis II. 3. On or around June 3, 2020, Raymond Honeywell joined the law firm of Corson Cotton, LLP, as a partner in the Boston office. 4. Given the well-publicized controversies of the Davis administration and Honeywell's role in aiding widely criticized actions taken by the Davis administration, movement, Greta Vinay Seville voiced her objection to a Corson Cotton managing partner in an email as follows. To Tim Cotton, from Greta Vinay Seville, date June 5, 2020, R.E. Raymond Honeywell. Tim, this is unacceptable. I realize I've only been at the firm for a year, but let me be clear. I will not agree to work on any cases with Honeywell. A lot of associates are upset by this, too. The firm should reconsider this decision, one made, I would like to point out, without the majority consent of the partnership, and therefore a breach of that contract. I do not consent. Had I known Coco was going to take in Honeywell after he resigned as Attorney General, I would not have left Stokes and Crane. Tim, how do you justify this when we have taken on several pro bono asylum cases? How will you answer the hypocrisy? Greta. 5. Managing Partner Tim Cotton wrote back. To Greta Vinay Seville, from Tim Cotton. Date June 5, 2020. R.E. Raymond Honeywell. Greta, you should be careful about maligning another lawyer. Honeywell is a respected attorney with great client connections and 29 years of practice under his belt. The allegations concerning the Davis administrations are just that, allegations. Honeywell has a right to defend himself. I see no conflict between Honeywell and our pro bono asylum cases. 1. Ms. Seville then responded as follows. To Tim Cotton, from Greta Vinay Seville, date June 5, 2020, R.E. Raymond Honeywell. Tim, they caged kids, period. Actually, that's the best of it. They did worse. Let's not pretend otherwise. I agree Raymond Honeywell has a right to defend himself. That is, if anyone in the current administration were to actually take the necessary steps to investigate, charge, and prosecute him. But as we have seen time and again, it is rare that men of power are brought to justice. Instead, they are forgiven by getting lucrative positions in the private sector, like Honeywell here. You know all of the parade of horribles he and Davis stand rightfully accused of, so I will not reiterate all of them here. I know you have obviously made your decision, and I do not wish to discuss this further with you at this time. My position is clear. 2. Amongst the many known controversies of the Davis administration, the salient ones for this motion are as follows. A. On May 1, 2019, Attorney General Honeywell ordered a private militia, hired by the White House, to tear gas journalists who had assembled to shout questions to President Davis. Honeywell later claimed he thought someone in the scrum had shouted attack, but no proof out of 152 videos of the event support that claim. B. On March 14, 2020, the New York Times reported that A.G. Honeywell had earlier drafted a directive that families crossing the Texas border from Mexico be immediately separated and separately prosecuted, no matter how young the children were. Even if the directive stated the child was breastfeeding, the children were to be confined, per Honeywell's directive, at one of the private prisons the administration had contracted. Let me reiterate that last fact. The children were to be confined, per Honeywell's directive, at one of the private prisons the administration had contracted. The same private prison that is a member of the Clients Trade Association, from whose documents Summer Brad found key document number 10 showing monthly payments to a T. Honeywell going back at least 7 years. The rest of the facts would take a considerable amount of work to strip them of emotion, of the colors and sounds, inner thoughts, seemingly irrelevant observations, and scenery that courts aren't interested in reading. As I start to think about these additional facts, the noise of the only other person at this monarch butterfly sanctuary where I hide is interrupting by humming the song she always hums, Eminem's Say Goodbye to Hollywood. Her voice carries on the wind from 2 acres away. Chapter 3. I close my eyes behind my prescription aviators. These ones, not progressives, but dedicated to the distant side of my complex optometry prescription. I try to focus on the wind around the cabin, how it plays the aluminum tubes and seashells of the wind chime hanging off the porch roof. I don't want to think on them, the culprits, the colluders, their crime, probably crimes plural, while I try to enjoy this hot coffee in peace, a pause in the action in my head. Who am I anymore, anyway? Will I end up like Aunt Violet? Gone? Disappeared? Or my beloved brother, Toby, living alone in the woods of Vermont? The only other person in miles shuts the door on an outbuilding across the field of flowers and butterflies. She'll walk back to the cottage soon. Who throws away their career on an impossible mission to take down a former attorney general and their own firm? At 37, I should be sitting at a paperless desk in any of Coco's 13 offices. Could be Tokyo, New York, Hong Kong, London, D.C., Columbia, South Carolina, or the new mothership Boston, where I'm technically based, even though I'm rarely there. I travel most of the year, always first class or business. I should be e-signing pleadings drafted by juniors. I should be reading a PDF binder to prep for a discovery hearing in whatever federal district court the firm's corporate clients wish to drop ship me to kill a burdensome demand for too many gigabytes of client data. Or I should be hosting an all-women business development luncheon in Soho, at a cost of $100 a head, for what amounts to a fistful of limp leaves and an inch of salmon. But I'm in the opposite of worlds. I'm hiding out with stolen emails that could, if I'm right about their content, and if I could pull this off, nuke Raymond Honeywell, probably nuke Corson Cotton, and who knows who else. The firm has politicians, global corporations, CEOs, influential trade associations, even whole states as clients. I open my eyes, wait for her to make her way to me on the cottage porch. I hear her humming as she goes about little tasks of tidying up around the outbuilding she just exited. She doesn't deserve this risk. I have great guilt for being here, because I know deep down, I bring danger wherever I go. I've crossed so many lines. A cardinal adds garlands of red to the fluttering orange and white and green of the acres beyond this porch, He faints and swoops as I watch him, thinking on my recent past.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?